Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are happy that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, it's a closer look with the Monitor. North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orledge discusses the global conflict that's driving oil volatility, but not necessarily drilling here in North Dakota. We'll also hear from the North Dakota Gateway to Science on what there is to do outside this spring. Plus, Dave Thompson and I will review all of this week's local and regional news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. What's the difference between the sound of a vinyl record and then a digital file that you might listen to music on your phone? And when we talk about MP3s, WAV files, or AAC, what do those terms actually mean for what we hear? Well, today on Tech with Peck, George Peck will walk us through the world of audio formats from analog to digital and help us understand what's gained and lost along the way. George, no better person to talk about this than you. Welcome back to Main Street.
So what are we listening to? You hear the surface noise?
Yeah.
This is vinyl. All right, so theoretically this is analog, right?
Right.
Except it's going into my console where it's immediately converted to digital. So analog is actually tougher to find these days, but let's just start there. So this Miles Davis album was recorded on analog equipment in, I should know when this was recorded, Craig, 58, maybe 59. I don't remember when Kind of Blue came out. But this is a blue vinyl, you know, 50th anniversary edition, which right away means it's not quite as good vinyl, I don't think, as the original or others. But this is vinyl on a turntable, and it was recorded in analog, mixed in analog, mastered in analog, put on a lathe in analog, and put on vinyl in analog, and is being played back through a nice Ortofon cartridge in analog. And then it hits my console and gets turned into digital. But let's just start with analog. So we hear things in analog. Our ears hear air pressure. The turntable has a left side of the groove for one channel because it's stereo, and the right side of the groove for the other channel. And the groove varies in depth. That would be amplitude, which determines the volume or the, you know, impact, and then frequency, which is a high frequency for the hi-hat or the cymbal. There's a bass line in here. That's a low frequency. So that's that. It's all done in waveforms. It's analog. And to many, that's the beauty, the original beauty of audio. So that's where it started. And I started in the radio business. We're on the radio. Well, we're also online. Is the radio station analog or digital? I don't know. I think Prairie Public has HD subchannels, so it depends on how you're listening. But let's just talk about analog because that's where it all began.
George, let me ask you this quick question. People often say, and I've often read, that vinyl, analog, sounds warmer. What are they actually saying when we hear that?
Well, so they're saying that they think it sounds warmer, which means it sounds fuller. I'm going to go back to it. The first thing I heard when compact discs became popular, because that was the first real digital format. So we were transitioning from analog, either vinyl or cassette tape or 8-track or whatever, reel to reel, to a digital format compact disc. And it was incredibly controversial and continues to be, but there were wars that broke out between, you know, vinyl enthusiasts and CD enthusiasts. And I remember talking to a guy and I said, well, the CD sounds, it's got better high end, it's brighter. He says, yeah, it sounds tinny. So this was the first thing we had. So the warmth is, first of all, vinyl is not going to get the same high frequency response that digital signals do. So in theory, it may stop at about 18 kilohertz or maybe 20. Now, the human ear may not necessarily even catch that. Mine still does. I still hear pretty good. But so then we have the other thing. I've heard various discussions that the reason vinyl sounds warmer is there is a much larger amount of total harmonic distortion, which may translate into warmth. So this is something that we can look at on a scope or an oscilloscope. We talked about that something. And you may see some difference. But it has never been converted to digital. So it was recorded as it was, you know, picked up by a microphone and very possibly a tube amplifier. And tube amplifiers, in theory, add a little bit of warmth. And so you get these variations to the audio forms that were recorded in a microphone and are played back on some kind of a, you know, analog device. I mean, if you want the pure original analog sound, don't convert it to digital. I got the wrong room. I need to take my turntable out to the living room and plug it into an analog preamplifier and plug that into an analog amplifier and put a plug a pair of speakers into it, because then it will be pure analog. There will be no conversion to digital, and we will get that real analog experience. I'm not sure I'm going to do that, but I probably should if I wanted to be a purist about it, right?
George, the difference then between analog sound and digital sound is just so interesting to me. If I were to play a vinyl record in the setup you just described, and you were blindfolded and did the same thing using the best quality CD amps, et cetera, or digital amplifiers, et cetera, from a CD player, could you tell the difference immediately?
I'm looking back here. I've got the 50th anniversary Miles Davis. It's got the blue vinyl, and it's also got a CD. We could do it. But here's the thing. The first thing I would notice is I don't necessarily hear surface noise there, but when I first brought that up, I heard a lot of surface noise, and that's still my main complaint about vinyl. I do not care how well you clean it and how well it's pressed, you're going to hear some surface noise, some worse than others. My old 1970s collection that I didn't take care of are particularly bad. So that would be the first place I would notice. The other place I would notice would be in probably the high end. Oh, that there's pretty nice. There's really nice cymbal there. That's pretty good. And so you might not necessarily, depending on how it was recorded, if it was an older recording that was original analog recording, you might not know the difference. But if it was recorded digitally recently, you would hear better, cleaner highs. You would hear better definition. So I would notice first surface noise, and then depending on the master and when it was recorded, I would notice better high end. I'd say those are the two things I think about.
When we hear that we're listening to an album that's been remastered, what does that mean?
So it means one of two things. If it's still in the analog domain, it may have been an old analog tape, had a lot of hiss, maybe some distortion. So if it's maintaining the analog domain, it will go through some equalization. It will go through maybe some compression, which is, you know, evening out the audio levels, and then stay in the analog domain, and there will be a new analog version. In most cases, it's being digitally remastered. So it's being converted from analog to digital. And then in that digital domain, there are just thousands of plugins and tricks and tips and approaches to get rid of distortion and get rid of, you know, maybe overemphasized frequencies in some cases, and to fix it. So it's being remastered, and the things that really made it original analog are being, many would say, destroyed, but certainly modified. So it might sound better, but it's not going to sound like what it originally did.
George Quinn, we are sharing our conversation that you and I are having right now. Prairie Public gets a WAV file for me, and then they broadcast that file. We also then need to convert it to MP3 so that we can stream it later. The difference from my perspective, not being the audiophile that you are, is the tremendous difference in the size of the files. The WAV file is much larger. We all listen to music on our phones. I'm guessing that
I try not to
because
I really don't want to
and go into that, George, a little bit, because it is different. It's very different. And it's because in my layman's eyes, digital compression,
you know, I was thinking we might be able to stay analog for the whole show today, but you veered us away. So if we think about the original MP3 wave was this little thing called Napster. And that's a long time ago now.
Sure is.
But the benefit was a WAV file is in fact, an uncompressed file the same size as a compact disc?
Can I ask you a quick question, George?
Yeah.
So compact discs are not compressed generally.
Right.
Okay.
So the whole idea was an original compact disc was a 680 megabyte storage device, and at, you know, 44.1 kilohertz sample rate, 16-bit, this is all the digital sampling, we had uncompressed audio. So 680 megabytes in the Napster days was unheard of to transmit over the internet. It was not possible. We were still talking dial-up modems and maybe DSL lines. It had to be small. So the Motion Picture Experts Group, MPEG, that's where it comes from, designed compression algorithms to take audio and look for things like repeated patterns, repeated frequencies, things that could be compressed into a smaller amount of space. So when we take an audio image that's a digital image and look for ways to reduce the size, it can become much smaller. So that was the idea of the MP3 file. An MP3 file might take a CD that was 680 megabytes. It would do a 96 kilobit bit rate to compress it and turn that 680 megabytes into maybe 50 megabytes or less. So it was so much smaller, and that was the advantage of the MP3 file, MP version 3. There are different versions of the compression. But it was a way of compressing music into such small sizes that it was easy to steal over Napster and pass along to everybody. But this first method of compression, especially at 96 kilobits, took so much information away that the audio in my ears sounded horrible, awful, especially with high frequencies, because high frequencies take more digital space, and the more you compress them, the worse they sound. So the MP3 was the first way of compressing. Yes, it was a great way of getting music transferred over very small bit rates and small spaces at an expense of quality. So
we can
go to next week and go from here.
Well, I want to keep visiting about this. I find it just fascinating. When we listen on our phone.
So it depends on the phone. Yeah, it depends. And I generally avoid listening on my phone because generally speaking, Apple, at least because I'm an iPhone household, even though Apple had a great audio format called Apple Lossless, and we can talk about that at some point, Apple generally for the phone and most of their music services have gone to 256K, what's called AAC, and we can talk about that. And that ain't bad. But if you're a purist, it is still fairly heavily compressed. AAC is the next, it's actually MP4. MP4 is the same as AAC. It's an improved compression algorithm that in the same amount of space as an MP3 file, it can use the same space, but it's going to get much better reproduction because it's a better compression scheme. It's going to lose less. It still loses, but it loses less. So it sounds better than MP3, but a keen ear will immediately say that's compressed. Mm. So it's better, but it's not uncompressed like a WAV file, which is still my kind of gold standard for digital audio.
I want to veer us back to the vinyl discussion as we kind of wrap things up here today. George, to make sure that there's something more that you wanted to tell us about it that we don't want to miss.
I mean, listen to this. You hear the surface noise. There's a certain, you know, charm to that. That's what takes you back to vinyl. And you hear now people who remix and DJs who will drop vinyl scratch in just to, you know, add something to a song. But it's, to a certain extent, it's just, it's got that just standard and kind of, the word I'm looking for is, you know, tradition to it, right? Mm-hmm. It's tradition. And it's kinesthetic. You got this big, beautiful piece of vinyl, and you got the you know, cover with the cover notes, and
beautiful artwork.
It's just really nice. So it's not just the sound, but it's the kinesthetic and the handling and the putting the needle on the record and the cue level, the whole, that great tradition of vinyl. It's making a comeback. More vinyl is selling more than compact discs are now.
If I wanted to feel like I'm live, what audio format should I want to listen to? If I want to feel like I'm listening to the audio live.
Well, I mean, live, if you're in a concert hall, okay, listening to the Colorado Symphony or Gregory Alan Isakoff or somebody, if you want to listen to that as though you were there, that's a good question, because you're probably in that concert hall listening to amplified music, at least without Isakoff you would be. He's not singing to an audience without amplification. The symphony might be. But if you're listening to the amplified signal, it's probably being digitally processed, and you're hearing digital audio coming out of those speakers. So, a high-quality, uncompressed digital reproduction of that, or maybe something that's analog. If it's an album, you get surface noise you didn't hear in the concert hall. So in that case, you would have, I don't have a reel-to-reel tape deck anymore, but some analog reproduction. But it would be hard to do because no one's going to record it that way. If you want to listen to that concert from the CSO, it's going to be on a CD, and it got mastered digitally. Uncompressed digital. There you
bring go. Bring us up some Miles Davis again, George. Been listening to Tech with Peck. You can find more conversations like this with George and I. We do it every Thursday at prairiepublic.org. George joins us to talk about tech that we use every day, including how we listen to audio.
All right. Next week. Thanks, man.
Fargo Moorhead Opera presents Il Tabarro and other operatic works in collaboration with the FM Symphony at NDSU Festival Hall, Saturday, April 25th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, April 26th at 2 p.m. Details at fmopera.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Spring in North Dakota isn't just a change in weather. It's a living science lesson. From migrating birds to budding plants, there's lots to observe if you know what you're looking for. We're back with Annie Beck from North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Annie, how are you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks so much for having me back.
We are glad that you are with us again today. Okay, Annie, you encourage people to get outside and observe seasonal change. What's the idea behind it? It sounds so simple.
Yeah, and it is. And it's so simple to access and to do. Spring is an amazing time to get out and take a look at what's going on. So I love the idea of studying phenology, which is the changes in nature, especially in this spring. So as we go through the seasons, there are so many changes around us, from changes the weather goes through, the plants go through, the animals go through. And so it's really fun to get out this time of year, as so many changes are happening, as things are kind of waking up, to see what you can find.
One of my favorite memories when we just moved here, our first spring, we had our little grandson over playing around in our backyard, and the neighbor girl, might have been three, maybe three and a half or four at the time, goes kind of to the back area, grabs something, brings it over, and there's the frog right there, and they're taking a look at it, and there's so much to see if you just pause for a moment and look.
Exactly. Yeah. And we get so busy in our day-to-day lives, just kind of rush by through things. But it's so important to take the time to really notice one of my favorite things to look at are those early wildflowers, from the very earliest crocuses popping up to other little tiny flowers that want to get out and get that sun and grow before everything else leaves out and puts them in shade. We live in the Central Flyway, so we have the amazing opportunity to see tons of geese and other waterfowl coming through. You can hear the calls of sandhill cranes and see other birds like warblers and shorebirds coming back. Another important one to always remember are pollinators. So taking a look to see when you can see the first bees and butterflies coming up. During the winter, they don't disappear. Some types do migrate, like our beautiful monarchs, and then come back in the spring. Or others, and their larva forms, or even and their adult forms, will either burrow into the dirt or into the stalks of plants from last year. Also, it's important to remember not to clean up those yards too early. Kind of a good reason to procrastinate and put it off a little bit, making sure we're given time for all of our baby pollinators to make it big and strong.
You've used the term phenology. phenology, phenology. Give me a science lesson. What's that mean?
So phenology is just the study of those changes. So it's a study of the cyclical. Every single year, it goes through these exact same changes. So it's kind of fun to pick one particular place or even one particular plant. You know, say you've got a tree in your front yard and take notes on when do you notice the first buds? When do you notice the first trees changing colors in the fall? And you can track those things year after year, look for different patterns that might be happening, or maybe it's a favorite park that you go to, that when you go there, you pick, you know, you take a hula hoop out and you put it on the ground and you take a look and see what plants and bugs and what other wildlife can we see in this section, and do that throughout the year and see how it changes.
Allergies ties into spring for many. How does that connect with what's happening in nature?
It does. Yeah. One of the things that's happening in nature is producing pollen, which is what causes a lot of our springtime allergies. So it might behoove some of you who have more seasonal allergies to really pay attention to those changes, knowing when certain plants produce their pollen more than others. Another thing that I think is kind of fun to check out is how things have evolved to happen at the same time. Like you mentioned with frogs, you know, at the end of the summer, they go from being tadpoles in the, you know, in ponds where there is more water throughout the through in the spring, to at the end of summer, when things start drying up and getting too warm, they turn into frogs. And sometimes those natural cues is what makes our plants and animals change. Or birds coming back at the same time that the insects that they eat coming out from wherever they have been during the winter. So it's kind of fun to see how well nature works and how well it's organized like that.
I love your idea to document this. It's something that I don't think about, but how fun would it be for a parent to have their first grader look back and see what was happening last year at this time? And now it's this year at this time, and to keep that little journal going. I think your best advice is for families who are out and about, maybe to pause just for a moment, 5 minutes or so extra, and look.
Absolutely. Just enjoy. Stop and enjoy.
Annie, thanks again. That's Annie Beck with North Dakota's Gateway to Science, reminding all of us that some of the best science lessons happen just by stepping outside and paying attention. Great to have you with us again, Annie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Still ahead on this Thursday's Main Street, gas prices are up, but does that equate to more oil drilling here in North Dakota? That's ahead on Main Street right after this news. This is a closer look with the Monitor on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and global energy markets are being reshaped in real time. The ongoing conflict in Iran has disrupted oil supply, pushed prices higher, and injected uncertainty into markets around the world. Here in North Dakota, those shifts are being felt, but not always in ways people might expect. Even as oil prices hover around $100 a barrel, production in the Bakken isn't necessarily ramping up, and the state continues to monitor, I think, the situation. Joining us to take an in-depth look at this subject is Jacob Orlich. He's a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. Jacob, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks for having me on again, Craig.
Jacob, it's my pleasure. This is a topic that I'm very interested in, as I think everyone in North Dakota is wanting to pay attention to for sure. Let's start with the global story. How is the Iranian conflict reshaping oil markets now, and why does that matter for North Dakota?
Well, I'll take the second question first. Everything to do with crude oil matters to North Dakota because it's such a big part of our economy. It's either the largest industry or the second largest industry in the state alongside agriculture. Nobody can accurately measure it close enough to decide what's number one, what's number two. So those are the two largest industries in the state. The oil and gas industry also generates, by some estimates, more than half of all tax revenue collected in the state. So anything that's affecting oil production, oil prices will also affect the revenue that the state government, that county governments, that local governments and school boards all receive. So it is a big, big deal to a lot of people in the state. Now, how is the war in the Middle East affecting oil markets? It's affecting it in so many ways that it would be impossible to list it right now. But I think the big takeaway is that oil supply has been disrupted, and that has driven the price higher over these last few months. And that has effects on North Dakota that are still emerging. It's still too soon to have any precise data on the financial impact that North Dakota is going to receive from this.
As we've noted, oil is hanging out now about $100 a barrel. Historically, Jacob, that would trigger more drilling and everybody would be excited. It doesn't seem to be happening right now in North Dakota, is it?
No. So drilling rigs in North Dakota, active drilling rigs, are still hovering in the mid-20s. That is very abnormal for a situation where we have these high oil prices. Normally, you would start seeing an uptick or even a surge in drilling activity as oil and gas companies look to take advantage of the higher prices. But we have several dynamics in the state and in the oil markets right now that are stopping that from happening. One of them, we heard from Nathan Anderson and Justin Kringstad. They're the director of the North Dakota Department of Mineral Resources and the North Dakota Pipeline Authority. We heard from them in a press briefing earlier this week. And what Nathan Anderson was telling us was one almost ironic dynamic that is at play here is all of these oil and gas companies had finalized their budgets for the year. They're drilling their exploratory budgets in February, and they'd released it to the public, to their shareholders. Well, later that month, just a few weeks later, this conflict in the Middle East began. So it was too late to modify those budgets. And in those cases, when you're dealing with these publicly traded companies, regulators in North Dakota don't expect those budgets to change significantly until 2027 at the earliest. But there's also still a lot of uncertainty as to how long these high oil prices will last, because a lot of the price increase has been essentially a risk factor built in because of geopolitical events. If those geopolitical events in the Middle East change, if they end, if something else happens, all of that can affect the price. It could go down very quickly, according to some projections. And in general, oil and gas companies are sitting back and waiting for the situation to develop before they make any large investments, because drilling a well is very expensive. That takes a large amount of capital, and it's more of a long-term investment rather than taking advantage of the price tomorrow.
And it also takes people. Is labor an issue here as well, or is it more about being able to plan for the future with an inability of being very, very responsive because of the budget situation that you outlined earlier?
I think it would be fair to say that labor and workforce are always big topics and potential issues in North Dakota, especially in the oil field. As of right now, that has not been cited as a reason for the lack of drilling just yet. The director of Department of Mineral Resources did say earlier this week that one company has told him they plan to pick up a drilling rig in July of this year. Another company has told him they are considering it. The number of frac crews, which complete the wells after they're drilled, has risen slightly in recent months from, I believe it was 8. That was active in January to 10 that is now active. So I wouldn't say that workforce is a primary inhibitor as of right now from what I've heard.
Enjoying my conversation with Jacob Orlidge. He's a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. This is a closer look with the Monitor, and we're talking about the short-term swings in oil prices and whether that directly impacts drilling and oil exploration here in North Dakota. Jacob, has North Dakota fundamentally changed how it responds to these price swings? In other words, historically, might there have been a different response with this fluctuation in oil prices that we've seen?
I think that's a fascinating question, Craig. And whether North Dakota has fundamentally changed, I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer that. But what I have heard is that for years, regulators and people in the industry have said the Bakken has become a mature play. The focus is not necessarily on a surge in drilling, but in using the existing production as a cash generator for these companies. So that is certainly a different dynamic on the industry side. I will say that a lot of the time we think of the oil industry in North Dakota as a cycle of boom and bust and boom and bust. Right now, I have heard from some people that consider this to be sort of a leveling off, a stabilization for the moment, with some nuance. It's not perfect. It's not a perfect characterization, but we do not seem to be in either a boom or a bust cycle. And that's good for oil field communities. Whether that will endure is a very good question.
So are you saying, Jacob, that the state is becoming, or oil drillers are becoming, more disciplined?
That is how it has been described to me. Nathan Anderson, director of the Department of Mineral Resources, likes to say that a lot of the oil companies in North Dakota have become more disciplined with their capital, with the money that they have to spend, that they receive from investors, from loans. They are being more disciplined. They are not jumping at every oil price increase to increase drilling activity. Part of that is a dynamic of who those oil companies in North Dakota are right now. There have been some consolidations, some mergers, some buyouts in the industry over the last 4 or 5 years now. A lot of the largest oil and gas operators of wells in North Dakota right now are publicly traded companies that take that long view of the market. They set a budget, they stay disciplined to it, and then they look 2, 5, 10 years down the road for what their plans might be and where they want to invest their capital. There are still privately owned companies, and Anderson and other regulators have said that these privately owned companies have some more flexibility if they think that this environment of high oil prices is going to endure, if this is going to continue for a significant amount of time. There is a possibility that these privately owned companies will begin investing in more drilling to take advantage of that. But right now, it's still a very open-ended question. Nobody really knows what's going to happen on the international stage.
Instead of drilling new wells, Jacob, there's discussion about restarting inactive wells, optimizing existing production. How significant is that shift?
It is significant. If you'll remember, just a few months ago, we were in a almost historically low oil price environment. Operators were curtailing production, shutting in wells, essentially taking them offline until oil prices resumed to make them profitable again. Well, all of those, we now have a larger number of inactive wells. When oil prices went up, that is an opportunity for operators to increase production, take advantage of the higher prices without spending the millions of dollars it takes to drill a new well. So these inactive wells are restarted and maintained by what's called workover rigs. The number of workover rigs active in North Dakota increased from 110 to 125, we were told this week. That's a 13% increase. So that is definitely something that operators are doing to take advantage of the current situation.
Jacob, one thing I've wondered about is perhaps, yes, there's less new drilling, but certainly North Dakota is producing and selling now oil at a higher price than it was selling oil at a few months ago. If that's true, that means more tax revenue to the state of North Dakota too. Can you dive into that
Absolutely. Everything you just said, Craig, is absolutely true. To what extent it's true, we still don't know. When you look at production numbers, when you look at tax revenue numbers, there's always a lag. So we were just briefed this week in April on February production numbers for oil and gas in North Dakota. Next month, the numbers for March production, the first month that was affected by this conflict, will be released. And we'll start seeing those numbers in terms of how much production may have increased, how that may affect tax revenue in North Dakota. We'll start seeing it next month, and that'll continue, and we'll continue to keep an eye on it. The state government is expecting I don't want to call it a windfall, but an increase in tax revenue. That will hopefully allow the state to meet its revenue forecast projections.
You spent some time living in Northwest North Dakota. Jacob, does this feel different to you, this time that we're in? You're talking about maybe being more disciplined, moving away from boom and bust. Does this feel different, a different kind of moment that we're in the Bakken to you?
Anecdotally, it feels like it's been trending towards this for several years now. I wouldn't say it's new. It's new in the sense that it is a different approach than what the state saw 10, 15 years ago with the boom. But oil companies have been trending this way for years. They want to be more disciplined in what they're spending, take advantage of what they're earning, and use the Bakken to generate cash, not necessarily as a growth opportunity. We're producing 1.1, and by we, North Dakota. North Dakota is producing 1.1 million barrels of oil a day, roughly, and that has gone on for I want to say more than a year now, and it's expected to continue in that range.
In your reporting, did people talk about the length of this conflict that they're really interested in? If it ends in the next week or two, it's one thing. If it ends 6 months from now, it's something else?
Yes. The length of the conflict and almost more importantly, the length of how long the Strait of Hormuz is closed. It is a huge factor that is difficult to quantify. But essentially, the longer this goes on, the longer the Strait of Hormuz, the maritime bottleneck in the Middle East, is closed, then the longer the world is cut off from almost 20% of the world's oil production. And the longer that goes on, the higher oil prices are going to remain. And global oil supplies are going to continue to dwindle, continue to decrease, and there could be some consequences for oil. The longer this goes on, the more likely it is that high oil prices are here to stay. It's difficult to speculate on what might happen 6 months from now when we don't even know what's going to happen a week from now.
Jacob, one thing I've wondered about is we as in the United States, we don't import a lot of our oil anymore. Yet these prices of oil sure impact us, as we've all seen at the gas pump.
Yes. Well, oil is a global market. So oil production is going to go wherever it fetches the highest price. If oil that's produced here in North Dakota can fetch a higher price by being exported elsewhere, that's where it's going to go. So that affects the price here in the U.S. because you have to pay higher prices to compete with that. And also, it's not necessarily accurate to say that we don't import oil, because the refineries on the East Coast, on the West Coast, they are affected by the situation in the Middle East directly, because some of these refineries import hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil from countries like Saudi Arabia. And that is, that's a dynamic because of the grades of oil the refineries are set up to handle. Every oil produced in one region has a different grade, a different chemistry, different characteristics from oil produced in another region. And refineries have to be set up mechanically, physically, to handle one specific type of oil. And that can be blended between different types to reach the right chemistry. But there are still a lot of questions about how much the refineries on the East Coast and West Coast have been affected by this crisis, because they did lose access to a significant amount of oil very suddenly.
So even though we're a net exporter, it certainly impacts us here in the United States.
Yes.
This has been a closer look with the Monitor and North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orledge, helping us connect the dots between what is happening overseas and here in North Dakota relative to oil exploration. You can read all of his reporting at North Dakota Monitor. It's always free from paywalls, free from subscriptions. That's at northdakotamonitor.com. Jacob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on again.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating 70 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota, and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenshine, and we know it's Thursday because of that walk-up music. It's also baseball season, right, Dave? It's good to visit
it
with
is.
You. Dave Thompson is our news director here at Prairie Public.
Thanks, Craig.
All right, Dave, let's take a look at this week's news like we normally do. There was a shelter-in-place order on the Capitol grounds this week. What's the latest?
This man came to the Capitol grounds, stayed to the south of the Capitol, and he was carrying a gun, and he had threatened to do harm to himself. Mm. That caused the shelter-in-place order for the state Capitol, and about around 4 o'clock, it looked like they were going to be allowing them to get the employees out through certain exits. The man was taken into custody, and then the next day he was charged with terrorizing, which has caused a little bit of a discussion. Should he have been arrested for terrorizing or not? The feeling now is if it gets him help, then that was a good thing.
Let's hope that happens. Dave, the insurance department has said maybe a moderation of insurance premiums after spikes because of weather and the pandemic. I like that.
Yes, and we remember a few years ago, there was a concern by the insurance department that, yeah, we're seeing, you know, much higher premiums, and some of the companies were leaving the state and not writing things for condos or some cars. Well, apparently, it's kind of settled down now. They're seeing some trends in the right direction, where the increases are not that high. They're still probably higher than they should be, they said, but at least you have some other insurance companies are coming back to North Dakota. We've had some pretty bad weather years at times, and that's caused some insurance companies to say, well, do we want to insure there?
Dave, UND Aerospace Program is predicting growing interest in its air traffic control program. Certainly a need now across the country for more controllers.
Absolutely, and I was glad to talk to the dean, Robert Kraus. He said air traffic control is the second oldest program at UND, and I didn't realize that. But he said there's really enhanced interest because you have a number of controllers who are now reaching retirement age. You have the same thing for pilots. Pilots are reaching retirement age, so there's going to be a lot of demand for what the UND aerospace student can bring to the table on that.
Kind of keeping in the travel vein, if you will, the North Dakota Travel Industry Alliance looking pretty optimistic, Dave, about the summer travel season.
They are. After having a down season last year, part of it was lack of Canadian traffic. They're saying now that there are certain things that are causing people to look at North Dakota and maybe come back. Number one, affordability. Number two, the opening of the Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library should attract a lot of business and should attract a lot of business to Western North Dakota. So, and the 250th anniversary of America, which is a big thing, you know, North Dakota's right in the middle of that too.
Dave, residents of Finley have had troubles with their water system this week. I think it's getting better.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe they're going to say maybe in the next couple of days they should be able to use tap water again, but they cannot because of a problem in a water supply line causing contaminants in the municipal water system within the city of Finley. It's a long process to get that cleaned out, and they're going through that process right now.
I think they actually ran out of water because of that break in the water supply.
They certainly did, and a lot of people had to use bottled water. Bottled water is great for drinking, but do you have to use it for cleaning dishes and cleaning clothes? You had to do that too.
And you need water for sewer system management too, Dave.
It's, absolutely.
It's certainly all related. What are you working on, Dave?
What I'm working on is a story about this nursing program at Minot State University. If you're a high school student who gets a good ACT score or has a 3.5 grade point average and you want to go into nursing, you are guaranteed a spot. They will reserve a spot for you after you graduate, which I think is really interesting. And it looks at a workforce problem because we have nurses. There's always been a nursing shortage, but now we have nurses who are starting to reach retirement age too. There's going to be a lot of openings for nurses. Minot State is stepping up to help alleviate that shortage.
That's Prairie Public's News Director Dave Thompson. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Craig.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 23rd. A sundog is an optical phenomenon well known in North Dakota. It often appears as a rainbow-like spot on each side of the sun. When especially bright, sundogs can look like extra suns flanking the real one, sometimes connected by a glowing halo. In rare cases, a third bright spot appears above the sun. Sundogs form in extremely cold weather when sunlight bends as it passes through ice crystals in the atmosphere, creating bright spots and halos. Sundogs have been known for centuries. Aristotle observed the phenomenon and called it perihelia, meaning with the sun. One theory suggests the Greeks linked them to the dogs of Zeus. Another holds that the name comes from the way they appear to follow the sun like faithful dogs. An English document from 1104 provides the earliest known written description. Over time, sundogs have been interpreted in many ways. Some viewed them as a holy sign, with the three suns representing the Trinity. In some Native American traditions, they symbolized hope or balance. Others saw them as omens. On this date in 1535, residents of Stockholm, Sweden, were alarmed after sundogs appeared for several days. Lacking a scientific explanation, they feared trouble ahead. There is no evidence that those fears were realized, but the display clearly unsettled observers. Because sundogs require cold weather, they are especially familiar in North Dakota. An 1897 article in the Jamestown Weekly Alert reported a rare spring appearance in May. Writing about elk hunting, Teddy Roosevelt recalled a cold morning when the sundogs hung in the red dawn. In 1912, the Emmons County Record noted that while the displays were really pretty, since they came with bitter cold, their bite was not so pleasant. Many North Dakotans would agree. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
A new movie chronicles the rise of one of the world's most famous singers, Michael Jackson. His family was closely involved in the production. His son Prince is the executive producer. Michael Jackson is played by his nephew, Jafar Jackson. An NPR critic who watched it joins us to talk about the film and Jackson's complicated legacy on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Planned Parenthood, offering health education for teens and workshops for parents on topics including health, relationships, and growing up. More at ppncs.org.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to Main Street as one of your favorite podcasts. Ahead Monday on Main Street, April is World Wish Month, and we'll catch up on everything that's happening at Make-A-Wish, North Dakota. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll see you here again next week, right here on Main Street.